Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an expert speaks with us about the U.S. president visiting Cuba. We'll hear about how the Cuban people feel about Barack Obama. How might the U.S. help in Iraq to fight ISIS? And a comedy show about bureaucracy, red tape, and frustration at the office.
The way governments are attracted to spending billions of dollars on grand-sounding schemes that inevitably collapse is something that amused us.
It's right here on The Voice of America. President Barack Obama has confirmed he will visit Cuba next month, a major symbolic step in the warming of ties between the two Cold War enemies. A senior administration official says the visit will be a part of the president's travels to Latin America. The trip had long been expected as part of Obama's effort to make as much progress as possible in improving ties with Cuba before he leaves office in January 2017. Stephen Wilkerson is an associate lecturer at King's College London and the editor of the International Journal of Cuban Studies. He tells International Edition Sarah Williams about his reaction to the Obama visit.
Well, it's just amazing in terms of the turnaround in the relationship since the days of, George W. Bush. It was inconceivable that such a thing could have happened 10, 12 years ago. So it is quite astonishing. It is rather incongruous as well, because the embargo legislation is still in place. So unless something is done to change that between now and the visit, then it will be a case of the president of the country visiting a country which it would still be illegal for its own citizens to visit as tourists, which is quite an odd state of affairs, really. But it is really quite astonishing.
This will be, however, a controversial visit because there are members of Congress, particularly those members from Florida, from the Miami area, people of Cuban heritage, not just in Florida, but others, and also, though, from human rights groups who are very concerned about Cuba's certain human rights status.
Yes. Well, the human rights groups make similar complaints about the United States' relationship with countries like China and Vietnam. But it doesn't prevent the government from having very good relations with them or even actually giving them favored trading nation status. So those kinds of criticisms, leveled at Cuba, it is a different case. Cuba's record on human rights isn't anything like as bad as, say, Saudi Arabia or China's. So those kind of criticisms should be easily deflected by the president. The Cuban-American attitude as well is, they are arguing from a self-interest point of view. It does look a little bit petty from the outsiders. When you're sitting here in London looking at it, rather more objectively, it does seem like a petty objection. I think that their interest probably in the long term will be better served if there is a rapprochement, because it would allow for them perhaps to get some kind of compensation for the properties they lost in the longer term, or indeed a way back to the country that they vacated. So I think it's short-sighted of them to still stick with this attitude towards the island.
Well, and also, finally, I just wanted to bring up, of course, the U.S. still has this military base at Guantanamo Bay. Recently, of course, that has been a very controversial prison site in addition to other, military aspects there. How does this further complicate the U.S.-Cuba relationship?
Well, it does, because it's one of the main demands that the Cuban government has placed on full normalization. They said that there can't be full normalization until Guantanamo is returned to Cuba. So hopefully, perhaps, when the visit takes place, there will be discussions direct face-to-face between the two presidents. Maybe some kind of deal can be hammered out on this and the other issues that Cuba has with the United States still. So, it is a step further along the way to a full normalization, hopefully. And Guantanamo must figure in that sooner or later. I can't imagine that they haven't actually discussed this yet. I think they must have, behind closed doors at some point, discussed a pathway towards full reconciliation, because that is one of the key factors involved.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wilkerson, for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
VOA's reporter from our Latin American division, Hazel Tobias, has just returned to the United States from Cuba. He was there for the Pope's visit as a reporter, and he joins us now here in our Washington studio. Welcome, Hazel.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you. You've got insight about this story about President Obama going to Cuba. What is the reaction there to this trip announcement?
Well, definitely there is a lot of hope right now because people are expecting big result from this conversations that just began last year between President Obama and Mr. Castro. So definitely people is happy and they have a lot of hope and they're expecting big things to come soon in their country.
What about in particular Mr. Obama's visit to that country? You think that will be a welcome thing?
Definitely. I mean, Cubans are very happy to have Mr. Obama. They know Obama very well. Most of any other politician, they really know Obama. They admire Obama very much. Obama's kind of a hero in Cuba. You said Barack Obama, and they just smile, and they're happy because it represents so much. From he is a black president, first black president in office, so it represents a lot for them. And right now, as I said before, this visit, because I asked people, what do you think if Barack Obama comes to their country? They said he's going to come soon. So for them, it's hope right now. For them, it's finally we're going to open to the rest of the world.
Now, is this only on economic reasons or is there any air for political change in Cuba?
Well, mostly it's economical reasons. You know, what they want is to have a better life. What they want is to have more income to their houses and to have, you know, be sure about they're going to be able to eat the next day. That's exactly what they want. They don't know the details. They don't know what's really going on in a political manner between Mr. Obama and Mr. Castro. But they just want, you know, to have a better life. And for them, the economical way to do things, so the economical issue, it's more important than anything else.
What about the government? How do they feel about this? Are they worried Mr. Obama's visit there might change the political arrangements that they have?
No. They're so confident on their own, so they think that they are managing everything. They think they have the control to do what they're doing, and they think everything is going to be under their rules, is what they think. And that's exactly the image they want to project to everybody else.
And you just covered the Pope visit, as I mentioned earlier. This is kind of along the lines that the Pope was preaching at the time when you were down there.
Yes, exactly. And it was very funny because Cubans didn't know the Pope was visiting their country back again. They didn't know about it. I was asking, do you know Pope is going to be today? And nobody knew. Because, well, we had to remind ourselves that the Pope just went to the airport and he didn't leave from there to anywhere else in Cuba. So people didn't know about this visit, but they have a very good they really remember the Pope from the last visit he did. So they have good memories from him.
And what do the Cuban people feel about their government? Are they satisfied with the way the situation is right now politically?
Well, their first and main concern is economically. Mm-hmm. So they respect their government. Probably they're kind of afraid of talking, you know, openly. But most of them said they respect their government. They don't care. I mean, most about politicals and the politician way of doing things. But what they want, it's a way to find out a better life. That's what they want. They want to have, you know, their own things. They want to be able to buy things. They want to be able to buy a car or better clothes or have more food for their family. That's what they want. And that's what they have so much hope right now about this meeting, because they think that's going to come very soon.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Hazel, for coming by my studio.
Thank you for having me.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The Japan Exploration Agency, or JAXA, successfully launched their X-ray astronomy satellite from the Tanegashima Space Center on Wednesday, February 17th at 0845 UTC. JAXA learned from data transmitted by the spacecraft to its Uchinoura ground station that it had deployed its solar array paddles, or SAPs, and is currently in good health. The original name for the spacecraft was Astro H, but the space agency renamed it Hitomi, which in Japanese means pupil, for the part of the eye which regulates incoming light. According to JAXA, the Hitomi satellite has been equipped with a suite of instruments that will allow scientists to study the large-scale structure and evolution of the universe, the phenomena of the non-thermal universe, and learn more about dark matter and dark energy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today and coming concerning President Obama's visit to Cuba, which we've been talking about here. And joining me with the details is social media guru Andrew Palchewski. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, of course, the internet is talking about President Obama's upcoming trip to Cuba. Social media has a lot of reaction on that. And it's interesting, President Obama actually made this announcement via Twitter. He tweeted out and said, next month I'll travel to Cuba to advance
that.
Progress.
A president tweeting out a big announcement like this, it's a surprise.
It shows the age that we live in, and this is the way to reach a lot of people is through social media. But on this Cuba trip, a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum have expressing their opinions. You have people, supporters of President Obama, saying this is a great move. First president in 88 years to go to Cuba. You know, this is a huge moment in his presidency. His opponents are saying, I can't believe he's going to Cuba. They're still an enemy, including Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, two of the Republican presidential candidates whose parents were from Cuba. So they have a lot of connection to this.
They jumped in real quick on that one.
Absolutely. And then, of course, people always make it about themselves. So people wondering on social media, okay, President Obama's going to Cuba. When can I go to Cuba? So that's the next thing
as
that follows.
Tourist.
When can people go as tourists? And we might be seeing that in the next few months, maybe.
You have another big story going on.
Another big story in Uganda. That country is voting for their presidential elections today. And the government actually blocked social media. Twitter, Facebook, WhatsApp, several other social media were blocked. But interestingly, people were able to get around it using VPNs and proxy servers. So you had this very interesting situation where people were complaining about the social media ban while they were on social media. So people tweeting about, oh, I can't get on Twitter, but they're tweeting about it. And people sharing instructions, here's how you can get around this block. So it shows in this age of technology, even when governments try to block social media, the government says it was for security purposes, but people still were able to get around it.
Well, we've seen this before. For instance, in Egypt, when they had their rebellion, the government stepped in and did their best to block people from talking to each other, even on Tahrir Square, where the demonstrations were taking place. But people did manage. They managed to get around it.
They seem to be a step ahead, for sure.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, fighting ISIS in Iraq, and a show to make you laugh about the audience. U.S. presidential candidates agree that the Islamic State group, also known as Daesh, should be defeated, but they disagree on what the U.S. should do to achieve that goal, especially in Iraq. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawy explored U.S. options with Kenneth Pollack, a senior foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Mr. Pollack, priority number one for Iraq now is to uproot Daesh. How would such goal be achieved with the escalation of sectarian strife and inability of the Iraqi forces?
You have to deal with the widespread sectarian strife and the state of civil war in Iraq. The most important thing to understand is that civil war is not a result of Daesh. Daesh is a result of the civil war. It is the civil war that enabled Daesh to make its gains in Iraq. And if you're going to roll back Daesh's gains, you're going to have to first end the civil war. And what's more, if you somehow could roll back Daesh's gains without dealing with the problem of the civil war, you're likely not going to solve anything, because the civil war will produce new groups just like Daesh to take its place. So the real key is to deal with the civil war, and that is going to mean a process of political reconciliation among Sunni and Shia Arabs, as well as some solution to the question of the Kurds.
What options does the U.S. have now to help Iraqi forces without boots on the ground or calls for carpet bombing against Daesh, as some candidates are saying?
First, on the purely military side, I think that there still is a lot that the United States can do. The United States could provide significantly more advisors so that we can provide advisors out in the field accompanying Iraqi forces, preferably down to battalion level, so that there's a much greater intimate level of cooperation between American advisors and Iraqi forces in the field. We can step up our airstrikes to an even greater extent. We could provide personnel with the Iraqi Special Forces who could call in airstrikes, or we could perhaps train a limited number of Iraqis, especially better English-speaking Iraqis, to serve as forward air controllers. And there's always more equipment that could be provided. But in some ways, even more important than the additional military assistance would be political assistance. The simple fact of the matter is that the United States has done far too little to help Iraq recreate a process of national reconciliation that would forge unified Shia and Sunni positions, as well as dealing with the Kurds, and to help the Sunni and Shia Arabs then hammer out a new power-sharing agreement, which will be absolutely critical to turning any military gains into lasting political progress.
Even if Daesh was to be eliminated from Iraq, do you envision a united Iraq with rising sectarian strife between Sunnis and Shiites, let alone calls for an independent Kurdish state?
I think that there is a high likelihood that at some point in time, perhaps even in the near future, we will see the Kurds go independent. The Kurds have never been terribly happy being part of Iraq. That dates back to the very formation of the country in the 1930s. As for Sunni and Shia Arab, I think that it is entirely possible to imagine them remaining part of a unified Iraq, but only if there is a new power-sharing arrangement whereby political power is distributed equitably across the population, as are economic benefits. At this moment in time, the government is wholly dominated by the Shia. The Sunnis feel entirely alienated from that process, and it has been exceptionally difficult in finding any common ground between them. And it's not because that common ground doesn't exist, but the problem is that the Iraqis are unable to bridge those divides on their own. They need an external mediator to play that role. And for good or bad, the only external mediator out there that can play that role is the United States.
Kenneth Pollack, a senior foreign policy fellow at the Brookings Institution. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
There's nothing new about motorbikes. They've been around for over 100 years. It's what powers this one that makes it unique. It's water, just like what you drink. Brazilian inventor Ricardo Azevedo has developed a way to use water to fuel his custom motorcycle. He calls his invention Motopower H2O, and it works by using a car battery to electrically separate the water's hydrogen and oxygen atoms. The hydrogen is collected and then combusted in the motorcycle cylinders, just like gasoline. So water goes in and only oxygen comes out the tailpipe. It took Azevedo 6 months and cost around $1,500, but he says it's worth it. His water-powered motorbike can travel up to 500 kilometers using just 1 liter of water. And best of all, fill up's a breeze. For What's New, I'm Doug Bernard.
The Australian office comedy Dreamland is now available in the United States on Netflix. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the show pokes fun at the bureaucracy, red tape, and frustrations of a fictional government office responsible for major infrastructure projects.
Fans of working comedies like The Office or Parks and Recreation will have something new to enjoy now, Dreamland. Originally aired in Australia under the title Utopia, the series looks at the intra-office interactions between people who work in the National Building Authority. That's a fictional Australian government agency responsible for nation-building projects like roads, dams, airports, and ship ports. Co-creator Tom Gleisner says that the show was a tough pitch to the networks, but because it touches on themes that anyone who has ever worked in an office knows, it got picked up.
It's set in a fictional government office charged with overseeing massive infrastructure. thrilling, as you would imagine. There was a bidding war. It's a universal frustration for anyone who's ever worked in a large bureaucratic organisation. I think they'll see themselves in this show.
Here we go. Security questions. Name of first dog.
Oh, Charlie.
I-E or E-Y?
I don't know. He's just the old Charlie. Didn't need a spell checker.
Try I-E?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
What?
Must have been EY.
Oh, we'll try EY.
We've been locked out for 24 hours.
What?
Co-creator Rob Sitch plays Tony, the boss, who is constantly struggling to actually get something done. Celia Pacola is Tony's second-in-command, Nat, or Natalie, who is also frustrated by having to do things that have nothing to do with the agency's mission, like filling out her bio for media manager Rhonda, played by Kitty Flanagan.
Okay. Natalie heads up the major projects division of the Nation Building Authority.
Yep, okay.
A respected leader in her field. She is also a tireless campaigner for...
For what?
Over to you. I came up with tireless.
Oh, but I don't campaign.
Oh, Nat, darling, you're the keynote speaker. Time to bring something to the table.
When did I become keynote?
I'm gonna make it Francesca.
The series touches on several familiar themes like real work being sidelined by the political or personal priorities of people that have nothing to do with building roads or bridges. Tom Gleisner says that such themes are universal, and that gives the show its appeal.
The way governments are attracted to spending billions of dollars on grand-sounding schemes that inevitably collapse is something that amused us. We were convinced there was a sort of kernel of a comic idea in there. So that's why I guess we turned our attention to the world that Dreamland occupies.
This is Tony, our CEO.
I just need to check your pass.
Well, she knows who I am.
It's new protocol, sir.
Because we're doing some work on this.
I'm going to have to stop you then, mister.
Yep, no, I get it. That's something.
I just put his name there. And reason for visit?
Well, it's not really a visit.
It's just a category, sir.
I work here.
Okay, put visiting for work. And representing?
I'm the CEO.
Put self. All right, you're good to go.
Thanks, Tony.
Okay, thanks,
Tony.
Make
sure he signs out when he leaves.
Bye.
The first two seasons of Dreamland are available now on Netflix. Negotiations are underway to produce a third season. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the agreement by executive and legislative branches in Haiti on a roadmap for governing the country until a new president is democratically elected. The U.S. acknowledges the constructive role played by the special mission of the Organization of American States in fostering a spirit of consensus among Haitian stakeholders as the agreement was negotiated and finalized. The United States also echoes the core group statement of February 6th, noting our wish that all actors will keep the best interests of Haiti and its people above all other considerations. The immediate job of the interim president will be to quickly hold presidential elections, which under the agreement are scheduled to take place on April 24th. A presidential runoff due to be held last month was canceled after the second-place finisher threatened to boycott the vote over allegations of fraud in the first round. Protesters took to the streets, and the perceived security environment deteriorated. Electoral intimidation, destruction of property, and violence run counter to Haiti's democratic principles and laws. The United States looks forward to continuing to work with Haiti and its international partners to further strengthen democracy in Haiti, reflective of the region's collective commitments under the Inter-American Democratic Charter. The April 24th elections will allow voters to participate in an electoral process that is transparent, credible, free of violence, and representative of the will of the Haitian people. Once the electoral cycle is completed, the United States looks forward to working with Haiti to continue the progress it has made in the past few years, particularly in infrastructure, agriculture, health, economic opportunity, and institution building. Fully functioning democratic institutions will make progress in these areas easier and more long-lasting.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email,
visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.